Hello, and welcome to episode 4 of Into the Universe with me, Michael Lang. Today I'm going to be starting the discussion on stars, and we'll be primarily focusing on the life cycle of a star. Similar to the two episodes on the planets of the solar system, I'm going to be breaking down the topics on stars into a number of different episodes so that things don't get too confusing. So, we'll see shortly that stars can have different endings, but every star has the same beginning. All stars are formed out of giant molecular clouds, which usually span roughly 100 light years in size. These clouds are composed of roughly 70% hydrogen by mass, with most of the remaining gas consisting of helium. Now, these giant clouds will remain stable until some event will cause them to undergo a gravitational collapse. Now, I should mention that the key aspect in deciding the life cycle of a star is its mass. I'll be referring to solar masses throughout this episode, and this is how the masses of stars tend to be measured. Similar to the astronomical unit, a solar mass refers back to our own star, the Sun. The Sun has a solar mass of 1, and we therefore measure other stars or molecular clouds against our own Sun for indication purposes. Back to giant molecular clouds. Now, these clouds can contain up to 6 million solar masses, so they are a hugely dense and vast area of gases. As the collapse continues, the giant clouds break into smaller and smaller fragments which radiate off the energy formed from the gravitational collapse. However, as the density increases, the fragments become less efficient at dispersing this energy, which causes the temperature to rise and prevents further fragmentation. At this stage, the fragments come together in a rotating ball of gas known as a protostar. Now, this protostar will continue to absorb the surrounding material, which causes it to heat up significantly. This is a vital stage as to whether a star will develop, as we will go on to see that a certain temperature has to be reached in order to initiate a main sequence star. So the protostar is continually contracting, which is causing the temperature and pressure to increase until it reaches a state called hydrostatic equilibrium, where the internal pressure is enough to support the protostar against further gravitational collapse. Eventually, the pressure and temperature will be great enough that deuterium fusion begins, which helps to slow down the collapse of the protostar. And this is where the solar mass of the protostar comes into play. Any protostar with a solar mass of less than 0.08 can't reach a high enough temperature for the nuclear fusion of hydrogen to begin and will form a brown dwarf. These die away slowly and cool over hundreds of millions of years. The larger protostars will have a large enough core which will eventually reach a temperature of 10 million Kelvin. This could be seen as the birth point of a star, as it represents such a significant point in the star's life cycle. At this temperature, the nuclear fusion of hydrogen into helium can occur, which results in a balancing of the star's collapse. Essentially, the energy released from the nuclear reaction is sufficient enough to counteract the gravitational collapse, and the star begins what is known as the main sequence phase of its evolution. There are two primary forms of reaction within a star once it gets into the main sequence stage, depending on its solar mass. The first is called the proton-proton chain reaction, which dominates through stars which are the size of the Sun or smaller. Now, I don't expect you to know the periodic table, so I'm going to give a quick overview of it so that you have a better understanding of what I'm referring to. Each element on the table is represented by a letter, or in some cases, an upper and lowercase letter. For instance, hydrogen is represented by the letter H, whilst helium is represented by an uppercase H and a lowercase E. The position of the element on the periodic table is defined by its atomic number. This is the number of protons within its nucleus. Now, the elements are generally known as atoms, and you can think of the makeup of an atom much like our own solar system. The Sun is the nucleus of the atom, made up of positively charged protons and negatively charged neutrons. The planets orbiting the Sun are the negatively charged electrons, which form a cloud around the nucleus. Now, as I mentioned, the atomic number of an element represents the number of protons within its nucleus, and this is constant throughout an element. As you work your way across the periodic table from left to right, starting in the top left corner with hydrogen, each element you come to will have an additional proton. For instance, hydrogen has one proton, and then helium, the next element, has two protons. When elements are shown on paper by their symbols, you will often see two numbers to the left of the symbol, one in the top left and one in the bottom left. The number in the bottom left is the atomic number. As this doesn't change for an element, it is often left out, which is why it might not be written down. The number in the top left is key when describing the reactions involved, as it represents the mass of the atom. This is the combined number of protons and neutrons within the nucleus of the atom and allows us to calculate the number of neutrons simply by subtracting the atomic number, which don't forget is constant, from the mass number. But why is this so important? Well, you can actually have a number of different varieties of elements called isotopes. If I take hydrogen, there are three naturally occurring versions of hydrogen, each depending on the number of neutrons. Hydrogen 1 has no neutrons and is the only element stable enough to exist without a neutron. Hydrogen 2, more commonly known as deuterium, has one neutron to match the one proton. And hydrogen 3 has two neutrons to the one proton. Now don't forget, the number of protons won't change, just the number of neutrons. So, let's go back to looking at the proton-proton chain reaction, which occurs in sun-sized stars. We know that there is a vast amount of hydrogen 1 within the star, as the giant molecular cloud was made up of 70% hydrogen. Once the protostar reaches 10 million Kelvin, the hydrogen atoms can overcome their electrostatic repulsion and fuse together. Think of holding two stick magnets and trying to join the two matching ends together. At a close enough point, you hit a barrier which prevents them from meeting. It is the same with atoms. Without the extreme heat, they can't overcome this repulsion. So the temperature is high enough and two hydrogen 1 atoms fuse together to form hydrogen 2. Now, hydrogen atoms only need one electron, so we now have two electrons coming together with the two atoms. So one is expelled as a positron, the antimatter counterpart to an electron. What also happens is that one of the protons in the nucleus becomes a neutron. This is referred to a beta plus decay, and it is an extremely rare process. Once we have our hydrogen 2 or deuterium atom, this can further fuse with a hydrogen 1 atom to produce helium 3, which consists of two protons and one neutron. There are four different reactions which can now happen with helium 3. I'm just going to discuss the first one. This is where one helium 3 atom fuses with another helium 3 atom to produce a helium 4 atom, composed of two protons and two neutrons, along with two hydrogen 1 atoms, thus creating the cycle. Now, each of these reactions produces energy, which is given off by the star. Energy that we see in the form of light and heat. The other reaction I refer to in larger stars is the carbon-nitrogen-oxygen cycle, more commonly known as the CNO cycle. I won't go into this, but it basically involves a catalytic cycle of reactions involving the continuous changing between carbon, nitrogen and oxygen through the addition of hydrogen and helium. This occurs at approximately 15 million Kelvin and becomes the dominant source of energy at 17 million Kelvin. Now, our Sun has a core temperature of around 15.7 million Kelvin and therefore only has a minimal amount of CNO reaction occurring within it. Now, eventually, the core of the star will run out of hydrogen and its main sequence will come to an end. As it starts to run out of hydrogen, it is no longer producing the energy required to overcome the gravitational pull and the core starts to collapse on itself. What happens next to the star depends on its mass when it was born. For a star with a solar mass of 0.5 to 10, they reach a point during their collapse called electron degeneracy, which is a pressure that prevents the star collapsing in on itself any further. Now, this star is getting denser all the time and its temperature continues to rise. At a temperature of around 100 million Kelvin, 10 times that required to fuse hydrogen, helium fusion begins to occur, creating even more energy. There are two branches to these types of stars, the red giant branch and the asymptotic giant branch. As the star begins to fuse helium, creating a core of carbon and oxygen, the resulting energy causes the outer layers of the star to expand. This will eventually happen to our own Sun, resulting in it expanding so far that its surface will reach out as far as the Earth. The significance of this is that as the star grows in size, the gravitational force the outer layers feel becomes weaker and weaker until they drift away into space and it becomes a planetary nebula. Now, I would recommend searching these on the internet as they are stunning to look at. Once the star passes this phase, you are left with the core of the star, now known as a white dwarf. This remnant of the star could weigh half of that of our current Sun, but is so dense that it has the size of our Earth. Now, gradually, over time, it cools down and turns into a black dwarf. The stars with larger masses have much shorter lives because they burn their energy at a much larger rate. Because of their size, during their collapsion stage, they don't actually get to the electron degeneracy phase that the red giants do. They are hot enough to start the fusion of helium, however, it doesn't stop there. These stars become so hot that they actually continue to fuse elements through to iron. Each fusion stage creates a shell within the star, right down to an iron core. Now, these massive stars increase to unimaginable sizes, some as big as 1,000 times the size of our own Sun. Once the star gets to an iron core, there is no more energy that can be gained from the star, and the core collapses in on itself. As it does this, there is a violent explosion of the outer layers of the star, called a supernova. Similar to the remnants of a red giant phase star, after a supernova, all that is left is a super-dense core. These can form one of two things, depending on its density, either a neutron star or a black hole. A neutron star will have a mass of between 1.4 and 3.2 solar masses with a radius of about 12 kilometres. The pressure causes electron capture, which converts the majority of protons into neutrons, hence the name. At this point, they are prevented from further compression similar to the electron degeneracy pressure, but on a stronger level. At the most extreme end, we come to the mysterious black hole, which occurs when the mass of the stellar remnant is high enough that neutron degeneracy pressure is insufficient to prevent the collapse below the Schwarzschild radius. This is a hypothetical sphere where the gravitational pull means that the escape speed is equal to the speed of light. This is why they are called black holes, because no light can escape its surface. And that is the life cycle of a star. Quite complex, I know, but hopefully it provides you with an idea of what a star goes through in its life and the different stages. I plan to look into some of these areas in a bit more detail in the coming episodes, especially supernova and black holes. Like I said earlier, go and have a look on the internet for pictures of molecular clouds, planetary nebula, and supernovae, as they are quite remarkable things. I hope you found today's episode informative, and I'll be back soon with even more information on the wonders of the universe on Into the Universe.